We'll record it, and Maggie can listen. Justin was debating whether to do. You know, he's really crunched. He just bought a new house and he's moving into it, and he was crunched whether he was going to join us or not. And I told him, you know, to take a year off. How much he would, you know what I mean? He's just like got it working to like stop for a year. How much he would lose, right? And he could easily jump in the next like level two, but by next year, literally he came to talk about it and my internet went offline. And I had to go reset my internet and wait like 5 minutes for it to reboot. And I was like, you know, total omen for what would need to happen if he took the time off. So he's gonna push through it, but we're gonna have to be supportive of him.
You can do it.
Thank you. Yeah, I'm excited actually now that I'm recommitted in my mind. So,
and I told him, and so you know, one of the things is the first two chapters are really just philosophy. There's not much we have to memorize. Chapter one, there's some terminology to learn, and chapter two, it's kind of like to memorize it. You don't really want to memorize it. You just want to kind of know it, know where it is to be able to, like, if you know, somebody starts talking about horas, you know where to go. If someone starts talking about whatever, you know, it's more for reference anyway. And then chapter three is like something to actually learn and practice. But Nisargadasha is really easy. I mean, compared to the other dashas, it's one of the easiest dashas to use. And just a few little kind of like how and when and why do we use it. That like, that you know, when I explain it, is so simplistic that it's hard to kind of forget. And then chapter four and five are again philosophy that's not really about memorizing, it's just kind of learning concepts. So, but then after that we get into hardcore Jyotish. So that gives him enough time to move in and ground out and everything of that nature. So he's going to try it. And I'm going to talk to Maggie on the tape. And Maggie will be back from India and hopefully grounding. And we won't be talking to a recording for message of her. All right. So I'm going to do, since it's our beginning, I'm going to just do real fast a few prayers as we begin. All right. I'm going to light some incense for that too. Om Yanam Twa Ganapati Gung Havamahe Kavin Kavinam Upamashravastamam Jishtarajam Brahmanam Brahmanaspata Anashrum Panutapi Siddhasadhanam Om Shrim Jyotir Ganeshaya Namaha Om Bhakratunda Mahakaya Soryakoti Samaprabha Nirvignam Kuru Me Deva Sarvakaryesha Sarvada Om Kreem Shreem Kleem Glam Gam Ganapataye Parabarada Sarvatinam Me Vashamanaya Swaha Om Pavagana Saraswati Vajibir Vajiniwati Yagyam Vastu Diyavasu Om Ring 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 Mila Saraswatiye Namaha Om Gurur Brahma, Gurur Vishnu, Gurur Deva, Maheshwara, Guru Deva, Param Brahman, Tasmai Shri Guru Venamaha, Manato Shri Jagannato, Madguru Shri Jagadguru, Manatma Sarva Bhutatma, Tasmai Shri Guru Venamaha, Vrishabham Charshanenam, Vishwarupam Adhyapyam Brahaspatim Varenyam, Vrishabham Charshanenam Vishwarupam Adhyabhyam Brahaspatim Varenyam Vrishabham Charshanenam Vishwarupam Adhyabhyam Brahaspatim Varenyam Om Borbhuvaswaha Tat Savitur Varenyam Bhargo Devasya Dhimahi Diyo Yonah Prachodayat
Om Param Tatvaya Narayanaya Gurubhyo Namaha. Om Hora Tatvaya Parashiraya Gurubhyo Namaha. Om Barabara Bhagavadani Swaha. Om Barabara Bhagavadani Swaha. Om Tad Vishnu Paramam Padam Sarapasyanti Suryayaha Devi Vichakshara Tatam. Om Buddhaya Namaha. Om Subhuripradaya Namaha. Om Dabhudinashaya Namaha. Om Somatmajaya Namaha. Om Sarvasakyapradaya Namaha. Om Buddhaya Namaha. Om Ain Kleem Stream Nilatara Saraswatye Swaha. Om Dam Danvantarye Namaha. Om Asatoma Satyamaya Tamasoma Jyotir Gamaya Mrityorma Mritam Gamaya. Om Shanti, Shanti, Shanti. Ah, Jai Ma. All right. So, have you listened at all to the first level yet? You haven't yet, right?
I have not.
Yeah, I've listened to... I listened to the recordings. I haven't done the video, but and I've read the chapter a couple times and all that.
A couple times, huh?
<That's good student. laughs>
All right. So, the big thing about Srishti, let's see where you are, Frank. What's your understanding of Srishti and why Srishti?
Why Srishti?
Why Srishti? Why should we read about Srishti?
Well, according to you...
According to you.
Within this, you were saying it's a map. You know, we know how we got here, but then we also know, you know, how to get back. I think, at least for me, one of the bigger takeaways, too, was especially practicing Jyotish is... trying to, you know, undo some of our own prejudices, proclivities, and, you know, stay above that, beyond that, keep reaching for that so that we're not so biased and can look clearly, you know.
Yeah.
And this helps us kind of look at things in that context. So
one of the key things, and it's a very important difference between... the Western consciousness and way of looking at things and the Vedic consciousness and way of looking at things. And it really became like, last year I read, I'm spacing his name right now. He's the history of everything, or something like that. He's the Ken Wilber. He's got this shaved head and he tries to look all Buddhist and he acts like he's the smartest man on the planet, even though his book is filled with so many mistakes. And, you know, it's okay to have mistakes. Just don't act like you're the smartest person in the universe. One of the things that he does in his book is he takes the physical body, the subtle body, and the karana sharira, the causal body, and, you know, he puts them in a progression, and he talks about the different states of mind, and he takes all these Vedic, Sanskrit, tantric, you know, concepts, and he tries to graph them out and use them psychologically, and. Some people are really into his theories. They're like, oh, he's the genius. He's the modern day Buddha. And I looked at it and to me, it's completely wrong. Like, you know, to believe in it. Anybody that believes in him, I'm like, they haven't got the Vedic thought yet because his basic premise is incorrect. And this chapter one right here, basically corrects, it gives us the basic premise. So whatever theory we develop, we're developing it in a Vedic foundation. You know, this guy, he tried to make this whole psychological system based with Sanskrit terms, but like, yeah. And so his big thing is, he talked about the, you know, there's the, we have our physical body, we have the subtle body, we have the causal body, and he was coming from the perspective that the universe got created, there's matter, and then slowly evolved creatures and algae, and then DNA, and then, you know what I mean, and it slowly evolved in plants, and then mushrooms, and slowly, it eventually got to humans, we evolved. And as apes are evolving and turning into humans, cognitive rationality is developing, and we developed a consciousness. So he's coming from that Western concept of this evolutionary reality that developed, that consciousness developed from matter. And while from the Vedic perspective, we take that as the stula, Srishti. That's the creation of the physical world. That's not the creation of the world. That's not the creation of reality. That's only the creation of matter. And from the Vedic,
it's kind of where it stops in a way.
it's the and so, but from the Vedic perspective, there's this awakening of consciousness. And then that consciousness takes on subtle impressions and it exists, and there's this whole causal reality that's born. And then that causal reality takes on subtle body, and then there's this whole subtle realm of existence that gets born. And who knows, millions of years go by with just causal and subtle reality. And then when the densification happens, material matter is created, and then material matter evolves based upon what exists on the subtle realm. And you know, there's a guy, I'm spacing his name right now, but his whole theory is called morphogenetic fields. Do you know morphogenetic fields? Who's the guy?
I've heard a couple of people talk about those kind of things.
Yeah, but there's Shelton is the guy's name. And Shelton talks all about morphogenetic fields, that, you know, it's like something changes in the field and all of a sudden it shows up on every country. If we look like civilization, it almost like it started happening everywhere. Farming started happening everywhere on the planet. Like, you know, these things were not just transmitted. It's just like humans got it, and it was that 100 monkey theory of like, once we get it, it just becomes part of the field, and everywhere it starts showing up. And to look at us as humans as just like, there's this Christian theory that they call it intelligent design or something like that. And so it fits more into a line with intelligent design, but intelligent design is just saying that God had a design. Where for us, we maybe God had a design, maybe God didn't have a design. That's way beyond our need to understand. What's important is that there was consciousness, and then that causal field, and then there was a subtle field, and then that subtle field has guided all the physical manifestation. So consciousness didn't develop from the physical. Consciousness developed the physical to be able to be a proper container for it. And it's called emergentism. It's like we emerged. Emergentism. And so the Vedic paradigm is based on emergentism as a fundamental principle. So one of the things that Wilbur loses in his whole theory is he calls emergentism as silly, throws it away, and yet he uses all the terminology that's complete. You know, if he uses the Vedic terminology, that terminology is coming from a consciousness of emergentism. You know, the causal body didn't develop from physical evolution. Physical evolution didn't create a causal body. The causal body created our physical evolution. So, you know, and if we're straight materialists, then yes, from a straight materialist perspective, physical evolution developed a brain, and then we live at the level where we don't believe in causal bodies, we don't believe in subtle bodies, we don't believe in spirit. you can believe in material evolution if that's the realm that you live in. But if you don't live in that realm, you have to get that, like, if you do believe in spirit and subtle bodies and all that, they didn't evolve from our physical body. You know what I mean? It wouldn't yeah. make sense. Like, our physical body, you know, like, the ape didn't say, okay, let's develop this causal body a little bit so we can evolve into a human. Like, it, you know, it just didn't go like that. So from that perspective, this is giving us the fundamental principle of emergentism. That, you know, the creation emerged from consciousness. And it's giving us some fundamental principles of how it emerged. And so by understanding that how it emerged, it's not just that we go back, but we can understand, the standard view is how it evolved, that's how we go back as well. But it also gives us, what are we made of? Because how it was created is also what we're made of. And if what we're made of, if this is what we're made of, it's also what's making us function, which is also how the planets are impacting us from a causal level, because the planets are affecting us on a causal body level. And then it comes down into the physical. It's not the physical body that's, you know, yeah.
So in, like, these words that you're using, like causal body,
yeah.
You know, there's lots of different, like, bodies and lots of different systems for interpreting
yep,
them.
Yep.
Is there a specific Vedic or, like, where they talk about these different bodies, or are you just kind of using general terms?
So in the beginning of the book, we only talk about the tri sharira, meaning the three bodies.
Okay.
And so we're talking about stula sharira, physical body. Uh-huh. So we're talking about the shukshma sharira, which is subtle body. And we're talking about the Karana Sharira, causal body.
Okay.
So we're doing Tri Sharira philosophy for the first half of the book. In the Ayurveda chapter, I bring in how I work with the Pancha Kosha. And notice the terminology, Pancha Kosha. So, you know, when we bring it into English and we call it bodies, we can get confused between Tri Sharira and Pancha Kosha. But when we call it Pancha Kosha and Tri Sharira, we're getting, you know, all of a sudden it already differentiated itself.
Uh-huh.
And I'll jump to that real fast just because we're there, and then we'll go more into what Parashara has to say. But so of those five, we have three, and then of those three, there's two that go in between.
Okay.
That are like veils or membranes in between them. Uh-huh. And of those membranes, we can consider them separate, or we can merge them.
Okay.
You got it? Okay. So, for all intents and purposes, if we understand the Tri Sharira, then breaking down the Tri Sharira into more complexity of the Pancha Kosha just becomes a way of deepening our Tri Sharira understanding.
Okay.
Sound good?
Yeah.
Okay, and is there any other philosophy view that you are referring to, or is that what you were referring to?
No, I mean, you know, there's like New Age beliefs on the different bodies, and then there's, Yogi Bhajan, and the Kundalini tradition has their own version, and so I was just interested.
How many bodies are they talking about?
They've subscribed to 10 bodies.
10 bodies. And so we can take 10 bodies, and those 10 bodies are all summaries of the three.
Okay.
And can they all, and I don't even know the 10, but if we sit down and look at them, they'll all enfold into three.
Yeah, I mean, 10 was the most I'd ever seen before. I thought that was kind of a lot. Okay.
But the big thing is it's really just like for example, the stula, the physical body,
mm-hmm.
we can break that down into inert matter and affective matter, you know, like our emotional body.
Yes.
With you get angry, that's a different part than just the matter part of the body. When we get into the mind, when we get into the subtle body, we can have the pranic body, we can have the thought body, we can have the, you know what I mean? We can differentiate it into those. So or we can just call the pranic body and the thought body both the subtle body.
Gotcha.
You know, so it's depending how we want to break it down. But Tri Sharira is fundamental.
Yeah.
We're not going to merge those three Sharira.
Gotcha.
They're the fundamental three. Because there's fundamental Bor Bava Swaha. Okay?
Cool.
Yeah. And, yeah.
Yeah, that's great. I love getting to, like, that's why I love this, because we're getting to the origin. Everyone's got all these things to say about all the bodies, but really, what's the origin?
What's the primary? And then when we understand it within a proper context.
Yes.
And why? And do you think that those 10 bodies evolved from the physical body?
No.
It's not really like when we get logical, like when we apply the logic of if there are 10 other bodies, would they have evolved from a physical body? No. Would they have made matter take the shape of this body? Well, that kind of like is a little bit more, you know, plausible. Particularly being the fact that we were plankton, a few million years ago, and then all of a sudden, like, boom, we evolved into this. Like, the chance of the possibility of chance evolving us to this in the speed that it did is highly unlikely. And then all of a sudden, it just decided to slow down. You know, it was this huge, it was like nothing, 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 and then boom, you know, everything evolved, yeah. So, all right. But so our basic concept of emergentism and the fact that the universe came from consciousness, not the other way around. So the process, Srishti, the emanation of existence. And notice that the key, I'm using the term existence, I'm not saying of the world. Because when we think of the world, we're thinking of some harder thing. You know, we could also say the emanation of reality. It's what is, and we're talking about all the bodies. We're talking about this, not just the material creation, but this creation of all levels of ourselves.
Like the soul.
Where'd the soul come from?
Yeah.
You know that you did the monkey evolve the soul? Was there souls in the monkey, or did we need to become humans to evolve a soul? You know, it's like the soul existed and it's evolving its container. Not the other way around.
Yeah.
All right. So and the first chapter of Parashara is beginning with a creation. And notice what other Jyotish texts are beginning with a creation section? Have you seen any, Frank, begin with a creation section? No.
Not yet. No.
and Parashara is particular. It's particular. And the terminology of both his creation chapter and the chapter after with the avatars is particularly the terminology being used is of the tradition of what's called the Pancharatra. And Pancharatra is, unless you're in very scholarly circles, is a dated term that very few people use. And instead of saying Pancharatra, we could say Tantric Vaishnavism. Okay. So Parashara is using Tantric Vaishnava Tantra, basically.
Okay.
And the first two chapters are letting us know that he's a Tantric Vaishnava.
Just with the knowledge that he's giving?
Just with the knowledge that he's giving. The terminology that he's using is, if he opened up and he said, the Parashakti, da-da-da-da-da, Vimarsha, da-da-da-da-da, you know, if he used a few other terminology, we'd say he's talking Kashmiri Shaivism. If he used some other terms, we would say, oh, he's using Siddhantic Shaivism here. So we would know, you know, what kind of principles he's talking about.
Can we qualify that idea of the Tantric Vaishnav?
Yeah.
It's good. I mean, normally, you know, in my conception of the timeline, you know, what we might consider tantricism, it developed a little later than what we might place Parashara. So are you just using that as a way to explain Pancharatra?
Exactly. I'm just using the term tantra because Pancharatra became in by the 8th century, they were calling Pancharatra as Tantric Vaishnavism. Before that, they didn't call it that. And if we look in the Vedas, what later became Tantric Vaishnavism was called Eka something. I don't know if I say it somewhere here. Basically, in the Vedas, it was called those who believe in only one God. those monotheists, those who think that all these gods come from one God, that's what it was called in the Vedas. And then in later more Upanishadic time periods, they were called Bhagavatas. Those who worship Bhagavan, those who believe that there's this single Lord who's in control of everything. You know, they're still using all the deities, but they're believing that there's this singular source. Who's that?
Oh, just a friend.
Okay. I was Namita-wise. But and so those that Bhagavata who are looking for a single source. And then as the more tantric Hindu literature started to evolve, we would call it more agama. You know, the Vaishnava agama began developing. And the Vaishnava agama called itself Pancharatra. Whereas the Shaiva agama started to develop, at first they started calling it like Yamala. And then the Yamalas slowly became what are called Tantras. And so as the Yamalas became Tantras, the Bhagavata tradition was becoming Pancharatra, and then later you just called it Tantra. But they were corollaries in evolution.
Mm-hmm.
And right now, if we look, you know, and it's funny to the going belief is always about who the professor in charge just happens to be. And the big Oxford in charge professor right now was a student of Swami Lakshmanju. And so he believes that Kashmiri Shaivism, because that's what he studied, is the fundamental beginning of everything. And it all came from that. It makes me laugh, you know? It's like, if it, you know, of course, it all came from what he's practicing, you know? And for me, and now you got me going off historical here, Frank.
It's one of my interests.
So when we look at the Pancharatra doctrine, they're using particular deities, and we literally, the first Shaiva agama, we see kind of showing up in the 4th, 5th century. And the first mention we see of the Pancharatra deities are actually around 300, 200 BC. And we see them not in any texts, but in the remains of certain temples. We see that in the plaque to the temple, that the temple were devoted to these Pancharatra deities, Shankarsana, Pradyumna, Aniruddha. They were worshiping them. And so we see this earlier time period that this was like way before anybody else, these deities were worshipped. But we don't have any texts from that time. We just, because you know how texts go, we only have this practice here. And then later we have when we look at the actual written text, the Shaiva agama, some of it's a little earlier than the Pancharatra written agama, but there's no any evidence that they were previous to that. But we can trace it all the way back to the Vedas. So, you know, we can say that both were existing in the Vedic time periods. But how did they evolve? And when we look at the evolution, when we look at the Shaiva agama, you have the Siddhanta Shaivism, and then you have the Shaivism that basically decided, it said, these Vedas, why should we limit ourselves to these Vedas? We can do our own thing. Shiva wrote this book. He's more authoritative than the Vedas. And so that became this method in the Shaiva agama. And when we look at the Vaishnava agama, they're the opposite. They're sitting there going, this is completely in line with the Vedas. The Vedas support this kind of practice. These deities might not be in the Vedas, but they're supported in the Vedas. Look, Narasimha, if you look in this verse of the Veda, it says, and the lion roared. And see, they meant Narasimha. And you know, so the Pancharatra tried to validate itself within the Veda, where the Shaiva Agama said, forget this, we're doing our own thing. We're different. We're more authoritative than them. And so they were evolving in that methodology. And they were evolving in the same time period where, if you look, in the Pancharatra, you can see some of the early texts have three kanchukas, three obscurations to consciousness. And then later, and then you see in the Shaivites, some have three and some have six. And then after a few hundred years, all of a sudden the Pancharatra has six. So, you know, you can see that they're borrowing back and forth and they're helping each other. Now, according to Sanderson, and that's his name, Sanderson, who's the big, you know, Oxford scholar, the Pancharatra, they just stole everything from the Shaivas. They just stole everything, you know? And which is kind of, to me, it's just like, come on, man. Can't we in academia at least be beyond picking sides here? Like, they all kind of interacted a little bit, and I've been with a few people and I've argued, you know, and I've like, they haven't been able to, you know, I've gotten to the place where like I sit there and I say, look, see, this is in this text, that's not in that text until this, and they can't disagree, but then they still like, no, but the Shaiva was first because our books, we have older books. You know? It's like a what?
Like that Pingree.
Like
Pingree's writing?
Well, the big thing is Pingree was trying to prove a Eurocentric perspective. Where these guys are in almost worse because they're trying to prove a Shaivite perspective. It's like you're in the Hinduism, like don't drop the you know, our tradition's better than your tradition stuff. But one of the other big things that I bring up with a lot of these guys is if you look at standard Hindu ritual is all Vaishnava. You know, if you think about in the rituals, the mantras you say, you know, when you do the purifications,
yeah,
you're saying the names of Vishnu to put in your mouth with water. That's standard Pancharatra practice. So, you know, so many of these like standard mantras that are done, even by the Shaivites, are basically Pancharatra based. And that's my biggest argument. So my biggest argument that, you know, Pancharatra was here same amount of time, if not longer, but I don't need to prove longer, you know, I just don't need to say that one's, you know, I don't have to say longer. But if you see all the Vaishnava use in the daily, in the Nitya Agama, the daily practices. And we have evidence that 300 BC, 200 BC, they were worshiping those Pancharatra deities. We don't know the philosophy with which they were worshiping them, but we know they were worshiping them.
Where's this whole Shakta traditions kind of play into this then?
Shakta traditions are coming much later.
Yeah.
And if we look in both the Shaiva and the Vaishnava, they both hold Devi so, you know, so much.
Yeah.
And when exactly it evolved out and became its own tradition, I can't tell you the exact time period, but I know that Mahavidyas didn't show up till the 10th century in your average texts. So they were just a bit, you know, just a little bit later. And the big thing is do we say that the tradition was later, evolved, or do we say that the codification of the system happened later? You know, and it's a big difference. Did Shaktism come later, or did the codification of the Shakta doctrine come later? But it's very different, like in what those two statements are saying. But we can see the antecedents of all of them in both Shaiva and Vaishnava Tantra. All right.
Okay.
So that's that. Did that answer your background there of how?
Yeah, that was good.
Why I'm calling that Tantra, Vaishnava Tantra.
Yes. Okay.
but it's very clear, and when we look at the terminology, it's only from one place. And I spent about 5-6 years digging into this literature, and before I decided to translate this chapter, if you asked me anything about Pancharatra, I wouldn't have known my left leg from my right arm, you know. And but I spent 5 years researching, going to different scholars, reading everything written, translating stuff, to really be like, okay, Parashara said this. What the heck's he mean? And then when I got done, I realized everybody else I started going to and asking questions, I was like, haven't you read this and that, and compared it to that text? And like, there was nobody. They all were just like aware of one text. And so it was quite an interesting realm of putting everything together. All right. So when we look at, and so what's that, where that becomes important is when we're looking at the Srishti, the Pancharatra Srishti is utilizing, I think it's 25 tattvas? What's the standard Sankhya? 24?
I've seen different, depending on, I think it's 25, yeah.
Sankhya Karaka, I think, is 24.
Okay.
Yeah, it's written in the end part of this chapter. I think it's 24, and then the Pancharatra is one more. They add one, they have one more addition to that, where if we were looking at the Srishti from a Kashmiri Shaivite perspective, we would be using 36. So it does, you know. What are the terms we're using and all that, it does make a difference. And I'm stating it like that because I'm not saying this is the right way. This is it, this is all, you know, this is the way everyone else is wrong. What's important is this is how those guys understood it. And what can, and when we look at it from the concept of darshana, this is a viewpoint. You know, this is, okay, this is Parashara's, this is the viewpoint that Parashara saw, the emanation of existence. And, you know, for certain things, we want to utilize this. Recently, I was working on helping interpret Chapter 6 of Tantra Loka, which is a Kashmiri Shaivite text, which is why I keep bringing up the Kashmiri Shaivism versus the Siddhanta Shaivism, because that's what I'm educated in, the Kashmiri Shaivism. You know, I had to change system and used it. And I watched how they took certain concepts that were in this, they combined into one, and other concepts they divided into three. I was like, wow, they took that and they used that, and they all of it's in that one concept. And then I went to something else and I'm like, oh, wow, they divided that into three. That's amazing. Oh, definitely. Why not divide that into three and, you know, break apart the thinking part from the feeling part, right? You know, so, so what we want to understand is this is the Pancharatra view. It's not the view that everybody agrees on. And it doesn't matter that everybody agrees on it. What it matters is for us to have a structural concept of emanation. And then, you know, like when I'm reading the Kashmiri stuff, I'm making sense of it in a paradigm that I have. I have something to compare it with so that I have a structure to make sense of it. I'm not digging in the dark, thinking in a materialistic philosophy that evolution happened and I developed a consciousness. I'm in an emergent philosophy and I can see, okay, so they changed this, they changed that. Got it. So this is just a little foundation to give us a better understanding of the other views. If we approach them, if we ever want to approach them. Otherwise, we just at least are living in an emergent view of reality. And which brings me to another concept. One of the goals of the first five chapters here is really to change our perspective. And as Justin got in level one, and Frank, you probably got before, but you know, level one, I'm sure, you know, helped deepen it, is when we learn Jyotish, the whole universe becomes connected. It's like, oh, my mom, my emotions, my home, all that's fourth house. It's all connected. Mars goes there, and my mom is like this, and it makes me feel like that, and then I'm like this in a relationship. You know, it gives us this how it's all connected. So, and it changes how we look at the world. So in the same way with this, our goal is to really change the way we look at the world from a materialistic education that we were given as children, and to start looking at the world from an emergent position. We're looking at the world from a true Srishti, as an emergent reality. All right. And then some of this terminology we'll use later, like we're gonna learn about Sri Shakti and Bhu Shakti, and you know, like when we're doing remedies, I'll sit there and say, you know, for this issue we need Sri Shakti, for this issue we need Bhu Shakti, and then we have the whole pool of remedies according to Bhu Shakti versus Sri Shakti versus Nila Shakti.
So, okay. So what is your what Ratna Pancharatna, is that the correct?
R-A-T-R-A. Ratra.
Ratra. So what does that mean exactly?
It doesn't mean... what's Tantra mean?
Okay.
Different people have different opinions and all that. It's a corpus of learning. It's a corpus of material. You could translate it as... if we wanted to translate it to what it's going to refer to, it refers to Tantric Vaishnava literature.
Okay.
Or Tantric Vaishnava philosophy.
Okay.
Or, and if you even want to say, we could even say Agamic Vaishnava philosophy. And you're making me, I'm going to go on a historical rant again.
That's good.
So, when we look, and do I do the, you listened already, Frank, do I talk about the modern Vaishnavism versus ancient Vaishnavism?
I think you might in a little in one of them.
Uh-huh. So basically, the original Vaishnavism was this Pancharatra Vaishnavism. And then in the 8th century, this guy called Adi Shankara came. You've heard
of him? Yeah, you get into this, yeah.
Yeah, and Adi Shankara created the non-dualism. And he said, you know, it's all one. It's all an illusion. Nothing's real. So it got to the point where people said, well, why should we go to temple? Why should we pay that priest? It's nothing real. He's not real. The God's not real. It's all one. It's all an illusion. I don't need to go to temple or support any of that junk. So Madhvacharya, he developed a system that said, it's not real, but it is real. He said, like, you are one with God, but your soul is a spark from God. It's the same as God, but it's different than God. So you need to go to temple and worship. And so he developed this whole... And so his philosophy was accepted in some places in South India. He got accepted in Bengal. When he went to Orissa, they said, no way, bro. You're nuts. Get out of here. They didn't accept him. They didn't accept his philosophy at all. They're like, it's all real. No, it's in Orissa. They said this is yeah, you're trying to get people to go to temple and maybe it'll work, but this is, you know what I mean? They weren't into it. And so he was 11th century. And so he developed what's called Sri Vaishnavism. So you had the Pancharatra Vaishnavism, you had the Sri Vaishnavism, and then after him, there started to be all these different offshoots and different like big teachers of Vaishnavism, and these different Nimbarka and Bhakti-based stuff. And then in that, Chaitanya arose in the 15th century. And he had a particular philosophy of Bhakti. And he didn't leave really any written teachings. And he went around and he basically converted almost all of India. But the thing was, when he converted all of India, like, and the big difference that, you know, I'm really familiar with very well, is he went to Bengal and they were all Sri Vaishnavas. So he converted the Sri Vaishnavas. And then he went to Orissa and they were Pancharatra Vaishnavas. And he converted them. And so the Pancharatra Vaishnavas of Orissa, they had Pancharatra with some teachings of Chaitanya. Where in Bengal, they had Pancharatra that had been totally changed into Sri Vaishnavism. And now on top of that, they put the Chaitanya's teachings without changing their base. So when we saw, when we could say that people, the Hare Krishnas, yes, they're the Bengali. They're the, that's the Bengali, the your soul is different with Chaitanya's teachings. When we go to Orissa, where this Jyotish lineage comes from, it's a Pancharatra based with Chaitanya's teachings on top.
Okay.
So it's a very different perspective. Very different, because they never accepted, you know, Madhvacharya's teachings. And so when we talk about these texts, you know, when I say tantric Vaishnavism, I'm talking about the Pancharatra, like before all that differentiation happened. We're like previous we're in the Adi Shankara time period before Madhvacharya did his refutation and kind of started breaking everything into different schools. In the Pancharatra, there's this, and I don't know if you've heard of Vishishtadvaita Vedanta versus Advaita Vedanta.
No.
The big thing is none of that even existed at that time that these Pancharatra texts were written. These Pancharatra texts were written before people were even debating that concept. Which to me, I like.
Yeah.
That was a very heady differentiation that came later that, I don't know if it really, it was very political based. Because Adi Shankara's teachings were just to convert the Buddhists back to Hinduism.
Huh.
So, you know, like all the politics got in there and theory that was really political based. And we'll see, Parashara, he makes a very specific term, Parashara himself, to sit there and say, forget this junk. All right. So we're gonna read Parashara a little bit here, and we talked about why Srishti, and you know, it's important why we have Srishti, right? We're coming from an emergent view. Let's see. It begins, verse 1. Now the distinguished Parashara, who could see the past, present, and future. So past, present, and future. It's called Tri Kala Gyan. So Tri, three, Kala times. Gyan, knower. So he's the knower of the three times. Parashara is that knower of three times. The knower of the past, present, and future. And how do we know the past, present, and future? We look at the chart and interpret it, right? The knower of the past, present, and future, Parashara. He was approached by Maitreya, fully giving obeisance with folded hands. So this is how this is beginning. So one thing I was going into that I stopped. So why is the Srishti in this different than the others? And here there's almost the text is being written as if it's a Pancharatra text. A Pancharatra text has to begin with a Srishti. And so that's being inserted in the beginning to almost make this whole Jyotish text a Vaishnava Agama, a Vaishnava Tantra, even though it's a Jyotish text. So it's standard in those texts, yes.
Does the fact that this text has some, you know, creation theory and, I mean, other elements too with some of the calculations, does that lend more credence to it being kind of the base text for Jyotish in the ancient days, or not so much?
No. But the interesting thing, and I probably talk about this in the other recording, or maybe not, I don't know if you're getting more history out of me or not, but if we look at the Vishnu Purana, it's using the same terminology.
Yeah.
And remarkably, they're completely, if you look, the Sanskrit is slightly different. One is written in a Puranic form. This is written in a Jyotish, Shastra form. They're completely different formats. Yet they're both saying they're from Parashara, and they're both using the same philosophical doctrine. And that's what leans me to think that it's not as much as,
you know, whether Parashara wrote it or not, the likelihood, not likelihood, I'm not going to get into mythology. And if somebody wants to believe that Parashara wrote all of them, that's their, even though it's separated by thousands of years, that's their prerogative. But what we can say, logically, without any, need to have faith, is that these texts that were written in the name of Parashara are coming from the same philosophical school. And so whether they're meaning that Parashara wrote them, or whether they're meaning that these are teachings that are in this tradition that Parashara gave. And so we're giving this tradition that's coming from this sage thousands of years ago, and that's been passed down, and these are the teachings this school understands, that we can say without a doubt. Without a doubt, we can say that that's what Parashara is representing. He's representing a particular school of thought. Whether we can say he's the author or not, that you got to have faith or not to believe in that.
Yeah, good. Yeah, that was always one of decent arguments I've heard for people claiming, the whole Parashara Jaimini split is because of the Parashara, the Sanskrit, is so much later, and so they dated it as this very late text. And I mean, though your arguments, lend a little more credence to that.
The big thing is, and when we talk about Jaimini, and I don't know, I think it might have been my level 2 classer. Did I talk about the Jaimini Mimamsa Sutras and the Jaimini Upadesha Sutras and the similarity?
Similarity between?
Between those two texts.
Just the teachings in them?
Yeah.
I don't think you get into Jaimini in these lectures, no, not too much.
Oh, not in the recordings, but I mean, just in class, have we talked about that?
No. If we talk about it in this class?
Yeah.
I don't know.
So it was probably...
I've heard you talk about it in lots of different...
It was probably the other level too. But, in the same... Just like we see this certain philosophical, viewpoint of the Pancharatra doctrine coming through the Vishnu Purana, as well as coming through Brahat Parashara Hora Shastra, and they're both being labeled as Parasharas. When we look at the Jaimini Upadesha Sutras and the Jaimini Mimamsa Sutras, the information is completely different. One is talking about Vedic ritual. The other is talking about Jyotish. But the approach to how am I going to present this information, and what is the purpose of presenting it? And just when we look at the Mimamsa Sutras, what they do is they don't go over all the Vedic doctrine. They say, hey, these are areas of dispute. These are areas that people are saying aren't real or have some issue with. And they only bring up the verses from these Karma Kanda Shastra that are disputed. And in that dispute, they give very short, terse answers that need deep interpretation to explain why that verse works and why it doesn't work. And when we look at Jaimini, it's the same thing. There's only particular verses that are pulled out, and it's these terse verses that are giving this clarification on a concept.
Mm-hmm.
And so the format of how this knowledge is being delivered is the same in both texts, even though what's being delivered is completely different. So that's giving us, whether we believe Jaimini did it or not, the methodology is the same in both texts. And so to me, that's what Jaimini means. And so to me, what we're about to read right here of this view of Srishti that Parashara is talking about, that's what Parashara means. Whether it's a person or not, faith or not, doesn't matter to me. what this teaching, that's Parashara. That's the energy of what Parashara is presenting. And so I talk about Parashara in the mythological sense when I speak, but from the logical perspective, I'm talking about the philosophical system that is being presented under the name of Parashara. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So Maitreya came with folded hands. Oh, great virtuous sage. Jyotish is the best limb of the Vedas. Of course, it's the best limb of the Vedas. Having three branches of Horaganita and Samhita. Among these three, the sages say that Hora is superior. I want to hear about this from you. And if you are inclined, please tell me about the origination. So of course, he says, I want to hear about Jyotish, but make sure you tell me how the world came to be first. Sure. They jump to it quickly. So basically here it's saying, you know, we're going to talk about Jyotish, but first we got to talk about the creation. And then Maitreya, from where has this world come to be? For world, he says Jagat. From where has this creation? And Jagat is an interesting word. The way my Sanskrit guru breaks down the cognate of Jagat, he translates it as gama gama, going. It's that which is going and going and going and going, and I'm breathing and I'm being born and dying, and kids are being born and dying, and people are growing, and you know, it's this thing that's just gama gama. It's just going and going and going and going. So that's his breakdown of Jagat. You know, what is this world? This world is this thing that just keeps going, it's moving, it's happening. It's not a hard thing, desk, planet, stars. It's this moving, this going. It's a verb. It's not a noun. You got that? It's a verb. And that's one of the big things with Sanskrit, is we got to think in verbs, not nouns. The world is this going. It's not the emanation, it's the emanating. Srishti is the fact that the world is happening. Very different than happen. It happened and we're here, and how did we get here? End of story. No, it's how is this happening? Very different question, right? All right. So from where has this Jagat come to be? Where is this coming, this going and going and going come to be? And how does it end? Please speak elaborately about the relationship between the heavenly bodies and living beings. And notice this right here. Speak elaborately of the relationship between heavenly bodies and living beings. So he asks, how did the world come to be? Tell us about the relationship between the heavenly bodies and living beings. It's not by accident that they're there together. And the answer is in the question. The Srishti, how this world came to be, in the strings, and in the concepts of how the world came to be, that is how the planets are affecting living beings. Now, if we look in some of these classical medieval astrology texts, they talk about the planets have strings and those strings are moving us, or the planets have gravitational fields that are affecting us. And they talk, you know what I mean? They're like looking on a physical material level.
Yes.
That's not what we're being taught. We're being taught that the fundamentals of how the universe was created, that the planets are having an influence in that. And in that influence, that's like generating the living beings. So when somebody says, well, how are those planets affecting you? Say, it's going to take you like, it'll take me about 3 years to explain it. You got 3 years? Because really, you got to teach them Jyotish first, then you got to teach them emanation, then you got to show how the Jyotish is affecting the emanation, and then you can say, see, this is how it works. It's the complexity is you know, it's a lot. But yeah, so we see it right there in the question. All right. And I'm going to take a quick drink. So it's deep. See how deep it is?
Yeah, that's a deep question.
I've seen some explanations about it somehow working with the chakras on some level.
The big thing is, where did the chakras come from?
Yeah.
You know, and Parashara is not physical. Parashara is not, that's not, and somebody that says the chakras don't show up in the tantric text till what, 10th century? 9th century?
I don't pay too close attention to dates.
Christopher Wallace, also known as Harish, he wrote an article recently on it. And he pulled out all the tantras and showed the first tantras that, you know. And minus his ego, he has some wonderful research. You know, you take his, you know, sometimes he, yes, this is it. And it's like, I'd say maybe this is it. Or say, this is my research. You know what I mean? Just that little, it wouldn't take too much to kind of tone down the ego. But minus that, his research is really beautiful. And when you look, the chakra concept came very later. And some of my research has been really seeing that before we had chakras, they were talking about bhuvanas. They were talking about different planes of existence. And those planes of existence lined up with where the chakras are. And so slowly these planes of existence, you know, there's the bhu, the bhuva, the swaha, the mahaha, the janaha, the tapaha, you know, all that slowly evolved into, okay, so that tapaha is based here, and slowly that evolves into where is that centered, and the whole chakra theory developed out of that. So we have antecedents to it, but is that, you know, and somebody can have their theory of how the chakras and planets are working, but guess what, it's their theory. Is that what Parashara told us? No. So when somebody has their planet chakra theory, say, that's a nice theory that you have. Do you call that Robert Cox theory? Do you call that someone, you know, like, you know, throw their name on it and make sure that, you know, it's very clear that it's like.
Isn't Sanjay lecturing on this topic this summer?
He might lecture on chakra influence with planets, but it's not the reason.
Yeah, okay.
Just that difference. I can show you how certain planets conjunct, you know, blow chakras out, but it's not that's the cause of how planets have their impact.
Yeah.
And when we look right here, it's, you know, where has this world come to be? How does it end? Please speak elaborately about the relationship between the heavenly bodies and living beings. I mean, it's the question is really clear. You know, it's not a question. Yeah, I mean, look at the question before. You know, Jyotish is the best limb of the Vedas with Hora, Ganita, and Samhita, and Hora is the most superior. Please tell me about it. Yeah, there wasn't really a question. It's a statement saying, I know this, I want to know more. And here, where has this world come? How does it end? Tell me elaborately about the relationship between heavenly bodies and living beings. It's, you know, very clear that he's saying that the creation, when we understand Srishti, we're also understanding that sambandha between the, let's see, it says the kastana, that which is stationed in the sky, and the bhustita, that which is stationed on the earth. By understanding the jagat, the Srishti of the jagat, how did the emanation of that which is going and going and going, tell me about that and how that is, that these kagana, these things in the sky are influencing these things on the earth in this emanation.
So there's basically an inborn relationship already there with how things are manifested.
Exactly. And when we look at how they're impacting the chakras, that's almost like, well, how's it impacting your health? You know, again, Saturn is definitely giving vata imbalance, but it's not the vata that Saturn works through vata imbalance. You know, that's one of the things that, yeah. So Parashara says, you have an honorable question for the welfare of the world. now bowing to the Param Brahma, his power, the word, and the sun, lord of the grahas, who causes the universe to produce its effects. I will speak about the eye of the Vedas as heard from the mouth of Brahma. Powerful, powerful statement, and so much is given there. So he says that the Parabrahma, and I went to my Sanskrit guru and I said, why Parabrahma here, you know, and this where it says the power of the word, the term here is Bharatim, so some people just translate that as Bharati, or Bharati is Saraswati, and how my Guruji, my Sanskrit Guruji looks at that is, you know, whenever we have the Parabrahman, where Parabrahman is equivalent to that sabda, that sabda, the sound. So the correlate is the word and the word, and you have God and then you have the word. In the beginning was the word and the word was with God. In the beginning was the word. So Shakti is the word. And that was with God. So there's God and then there's the word. So there's the Parabrahman, God, and there's his Shakti, the word. In the beginning was the word and the word was with God. So we're looking at word, we're looking at not just word, but we're looking at it as vak, we're looking at it as speech. And speech is consciousness in the Vedic doctrine. So when we say the emanation of consciousness, we could say there's God and then there's consciousness. There's that which is, you know, that supreme beyond everything, and then there's consciousness. When we say vak, we could also translate it as consciousness. And so here, whether we call it the word, whether we call it consciousness, whether we call it Saraswati, bottom line is there's the supreme beyond everything, para. Para means beyond. The Parabrahman, the not just God, but God beyond God, you know, the beyond God, that which is beyond anything, and his manifestation, his Shakti. So he bows to the Parabrahman, that which is beyond, and the Shakti, be it consciousness, word, that first manifestation, the female embodiment of the supreme. And then the sun, the lord of the grahas, who causes the universe to produce its effects.
I often see a lot of people to equate consciousness with, you know, the ground of being, or like the highest thing, you know, like the whole universe is consciousness. So, but this is distinguishing a little different. So that, you know, Parabrahma, that's beyond even that.
And so from this doctrine, when we say that, you know, the supreme consciousness, we mean Shakti, we mean the goddess, because now we're getting stuck slightly in terminology then too, because you'll see when I talk about the Purusha, and the three types of Purusha later, those Purusha, they're consciousness only, and so we're limited in words. Slightly. And when we say they're consciousness only, it means they're states of being. They're not things that are doing. The difference between a doing, and so when somebody says it's all consciousness, it's like, well, what's the Sanskrit word you're intending? Because we become limited in English.
Yeah.
So it really depends how we want to phrase it, in what text, and how they're using it. But here, his prayer is to that which is beyond everything. You could almost say, you know, and from the Pancharatra doctrine, not the later Bengali Vaishnavism, but from the Pancharatra doctrine, when we say the Parabrahman, we're also, it's equivalent to Buddha's Shunya. It's emptiness. It's beyond a thing. Anything that you say it is, it's already beyond that. And when we say Bharati, when we say the word, it's consciousness, it's awareness, it's there's a movement happening. In the Parabrahman, there's not a movement. In the word, in consciousness, there's a movement.
And that's the key. That's the key differentiation. And I don't mean by just key differentiation. It's that differentiation is the key. The whole next chapter, chapter two, is that key. The chapter two is for us to understand that key. That Parabrahman doesn't move, and that, you know, his Shakti moves. And what is that movement? All of chapter two is what is that movement? So one moves, one is not one. There's nothing to move.
Yeah.
but just underline the word. Underline the sentence on page four. The sun, the lord of the grahas, who causes the universe to produce its effects. Because I spend maybe four or five pages just breaking, you know, like breaking my head, breaking that down in chapter two. The sun, the lord of the grahas, who causes the universe to produce its effects. And again, now bowing to the Parabrahman, his power, the word, and the sun, the lord of the grahas, who causes the universe to produce its effects. If you know, the reverence that I can say that with. I hope to share by the end of these first two chapters. So somebody put a note at the end of chapter two for us to go back to page four and reread this. Go ahead on the at the end of chapter two.
Okay. Breaking my book in here.
Let's see.
You have the how do you pronounce that?
Antikytherian mechanism?
Yeah, that's
really interesting. It's key.
Page
76. Speak about the eye of the Vedas, and so, who rules the eye? Which graha? The power of sight.
Sun.
The sun.
That's what I would guess.
And so here he worships the sun, lord of the grahas, who causes the universe to produce its effects, and now he speaks of the eye of the Vedas. So that eye of the Vedas and the sun are related there. And have you seen the symbol that I work with on my Facebook page and that I've been trying to develop into some better logo? I haven't got it just right yet, but it's a sun with an eye in it. And I'm digging into this verse right here. You know, that worship of the sun as Lord of the Grahas, creating the effects of the universe as the eye of the Vedas. Let's see, next. Verse 7. We're only on verse 7. Look, he's the profoundness of the universe he's given us. You will certainly get good results to teach... Okay, now he's talking about students. You will certainly get good results to teach this to one who is peaceful, respects their teachers, speaks the truth at all times, and believes in a higher power. And so, I go into this, I think, in depth on the recording, so I'm not going to go into that now. Right?
Yeah, you cover some of it.
Yeah, I go in depth there. And that's just really telling us what are the qualities that we want to look for in somebody who teaches Jyotish. And who do we want to teach Jyotish to, and who do we want to avoid even talking about Jyotish with?
Did you ever reject students?
Yes, occasionally.
Okay.
But I don't... I never reject them. I always just... say, you know, I think you'd be better studying with this person. Your charts match better. You both have this and that. Like, I think they would be able to give it to you, help you understand much better than me. So I don't reject, but I refer.
Okay.
Reroute, yeah. All right. So number six here.
no, page 6, verse 9. The beauty of this verse. And to me, I think this is so beautiful that some of the Kashmiri stuff, you find in the Kashmiri stuff where they make jokes about Vaishnavas and Buddhists all the time. They're like, those Buddhists who da 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 da. Oh, those Vaishnavas, they're just crazy. They got if you got bad enough karma to incarnate as a Vaishnava and learn that wingnut philosophy, then when you reincarnate and learn our philosophy, they make statements like that in their shastra, you know? you don't find that in the traditional Pancharatra. Instead, we find like this. That one unmanifest, eternal, all-pervasive Lord, the pure essence and master of the universe. And that master of the universe is that master of the going and going and going. That's what he's referring to. Is both formless, nirguna, and endowed with form, triguna. The maker of samsara, the efficient calls accompanied by Shri, splendorous. So that's what that's how he describes divinity, which I think is beautiful, and he makes it. There's no accident here where he says it's nirguna and triguna. So he's saying there's form and it's formless. Now, if you look at the Bengali school of Vaishnavism, they refute that God is formless. They're anti-formless God. And they believe God has form, of course. If you believe he's form, if you don't believe in form, then when you die, you'll reincarnate because you didn't notice his form. But here, that's not the teaching. Parashara is saying that it's both with form and without form. And on a certain level, and we find this again and again in the Pancharatra Shastra, is in the Pancharatra Shastra, the original, it's okay holding contradictions. How can it be formless and with form? You know, if we get really logical and materialistic, we say, well, it either has to be formless or it has to have a form. How can it be both? But, you know, in the Pancharatra, they're like, nah, man, that's your rational brain talking. That's the material world. That's Stula Sharira. You know, we're not talking Stula Sharira here. We're so far beyond Stula Sharira. And the realm we're talking about, you can be formless and with form. Like, it's not about either or. It's all. You know, in the very beginning, the one unmanifest, eternal, all-pervasive. That which is all is both. Nirguna and Triguna. So he really gets rid of this like different school view, which according to some puts him in a different school. But I like to see it as he's you know really saying we're not differentiating gods, we're not differentiating forms here. It's unmanifest, it's eternal, it has form, it's formless. It's that which has made the samsara. It's that which has made this, you know, thing that we're believing in. And it's accompanied by his efficient calls. And now, efficient calls. Does that mean anything to you, Frank? Have you studied the philosophy enough?
Idea where, yeah, I mean, it needs the Shakti to manifest, so...
No, that's more the Tantra, but when we go before the Tantra, back early Sankhya, like pre-BC time period Upanishadic realm, and we start looking at the philosophical debates at that time period, the big debate was, well, if, you know, and how we just mentioned before, you know, well, if God is Parabrahman, and he's beyond anything, and he's not moving, then how did he create the universe? If your God doesn't move, if he's empty, then where'd the world come from? So, and if he made the world, then he's moving. Then he's not moving, then your God doesn't exist, this unmoving God. So it was an early philosophical debate of how can we have this beyond manifestation thing, who made manifestation. You know, manifestation had to come from something that's manifest. So it's a very old philosophical debate in the Vedic doctrines and in the in the Darshana schools. In you see it in the and so the whole concept of Purusha and Prakriti, that differentiating, saying, well, there's Purusha and then there's Prakriti, and Prakriti, she made the whole universe. Purusha just isn't. And so that was them kind of separating this non-moving from moving part. So when he says Namita here, this efficient cause, what he's meaning is he's making it clear, again, that philosophical doctrine that's debating. He says there's this Parabrahman that's Shunya, that doesn't move, and then his efficient cause, which is Shri. She's moving. She's the efficient cause. Like, she's making everything, he's not. So he's differentiating there. And he's really kind of, in those two statements, the Triguna, Nirguna, and stating the efficient cause, he's really sitting there, and a bunch of debates that were in the ancient world, he's saying, this is where I stand on all those debates. So it's very heavily loaded, particularly if you know the philosophical background. All right. Then we jump over verse 10. 10, yeah. From one quarter of himself, he creates the whole universe playfully. And so this is an interesting verse that we see again and again in the Pancharatra doctrine. And we don't see this in the other doctrines, which, you know, is again giving us like, well, where is this coming from? Why it's, and this is their view. And I have different concepts on where he's going and why he's going and why the Pancharatra has this view here. But so if we go to the Rig Veda itself says, and let's actually pull off the shelf the actual 1093 Purusha Suktam. And so in the Purusha Suktam, in the Veda itself, they give us a creation story. And so remember, the Pancharatra is always trying to be in line with the Veda. They're like, no, we didn't make this up. We're just explaining the Veda. this is not, we're completely Vedically sanctioned here. Yeah, that's, you know, it's the big argument of the Pancharatra. All right, so Purusha Sukta. Verse, and I'm going to, this right here is verse 3. I'm going to read the whole thing. Purusha, who has 1,000 heads, 1,000 eyes, 1,000 feet, invested the earth in all directions, exceeds it by a space measuring 10 fingers. Purusha is verily all this visible world, all that is and all that is to be. He is also the Lord of immortality, for he mounts beyond his own condition for the good of living beings. Such is his greatness, and Purusha is greater even than this. All beings are one-fourth of him. His other three-fourths, being immortal, abide in heaven. So this whole manifestation is one-quarter of him. And the other three, they abide in heaven. Now, what's the term they use for heaven here? The Vedic term for heaven? You guys know the Vedic term for heaven? I love the Vedic. No, the Amrit. The Amrit.
No, Amrit.
They live in the immortal realm. In the immortal... Amrit. Amrit. The not dead. The immortal realm. So in the immortal realm. The other three are in the immortal realm. You know? The other three are in the Amrit. Three-fourths of Purusha ascended. The other fourth that remained in this world proceeds repeatedly. So that one-fourth that's not in the Amrit, it's manifesting repeatedly, diversified in so many different forms, went to all animate and inanimate creation. So all physical and living beings are coming from this one-fourth that's manifest. From him was born Virat. Virat means the creator. And from Virat Purusha, the he who is the creator, he as soon as he was born became manifest and afterwards created the earth in the corporeal forms. Then the gods perform the sacrifice with Purusha as the offering. And it goes, and it's a much bigger verse that has so, so much symbolism. So, so much symbolism.
about it's one of the Vedic creation stories.
So we can see that in this Pancharatra, they're weaving in this Vedic creation story. And in the Pancharatra Shastra, Purusha Sukta is one of the core suktas. Sri Sukta, Purusha Sukta, there's a few other suktas that are just core teachings in the Pancharatra Agama. So here it says, from one quarter of him, he creates the whole universe playfully. Now notice the one thing that it added.
Playfully.
Not only did he create, but it was just a game. It's just this playful thing. From one quarter, it was, you know, this playful emanation. So why are the planets doing what they're doing? It's a playful game. Like, they're not really, you know, yes, they're suffering and darkness and all that, but it's playful. It's the Purusha's playful emanation. The Leela, exactly. The other three quarters of him are unchanging, Amrita, and known by the seers of reality, by proper perception of the root matter, of the one part. Now this verse, 11, the other verses are relatively standard translation that you'll find in most texts. I translate this very different than other people. Just so you know, like my view is very different on how that Sanskrit works out. And we'll go a little deeper into this, and then quickly through the other ones, and then we'll finish this section for the night. So the other three quarters of him are unchanging. So those other three quarters, where in the Vedas it said those other three quarters, they're in. You know what I mean? They're in heaven. They're in the Amrit. Here it's just they are Amrit. You know what I mean? They're unchanging. They're immortal. They're beyond manifestation. They've never manifested to unmanifest. They're unmoving. They're in the realm beyond. And are known by the seers of reality. So the term is tattva. Tattva means. Tat means that, twa means this, ness, N-E-S. Twa is like, you know. So tat, that-ness. Twa means that-ness. Huh. So we can say reality, the this, you know, the all this or all that, you know, the that-ness, that's tatwa. Darshini, those who see. So the seers of that. Of thatness, the tattva darshini. And this is a term that we find in some of the sacred texts. Our goal, one of our goals, you know, as Jyotishis, our highest goals is to become tattva darshini, is to understand this whole creation. Like, why is it happening? Why is it here? What's it made out of? And not just know, not just like say, oh, Bhagwan, save me, I'm so dumb and I can't do anything, just save me. Like, yeah, we do that too. But, you know, that's not, we're not just, you know, we're humble, but our goal is I am here to perceive. I'm here to perceive reality. Show me thatness. Show me that. What is this? And not just what is this material, but what is this? On every level of its being. What is this? So that tattva darshini. So our goal is at all of us as yogis of the realm of Jyotish is to become tattva darshini. To understand it. This whole, you know, and if I say the matter or the how the planets are working or how they're emanating, I've just limited what the understanding is. All right. So the other three quarters of him are unchanging and known by the tattva darshini, by proper perception. So now he's telling us, how do we become tattva darshini? By proper perception, correct perception. And the term is tat pramana. So pramana means, and this is a standard term in Vedic, it means to measure, to calculate, to really look at and to be able to evaluate. the pradhanam. And pradhanam means, and this is something we find in the Sankhya Shastra that they don't teach too much, but because, you know, everybody teaches Sankhya just to get to the end of it. They don't teach it as an understanding of emergentism. But pradhana, when we talk about creation in the Sankhya, and do you know what I mean when I say Sankhya?
No, I was just about to ask you.
Okay. I know Frank does, so... I don't know if I want to break it. It's a whole different divergent realm. So I'll make it. I'll simplify
to balance
it.
Which words I ask. Yes, I was like, Sankhya. Yeah. I don't know. That sounds important.
So Sankhya. We're gonna learn at the end of the chapter. We'll learn this version of Sankhya. But the concept is okay. So there's mind, there's consciousness, there's memory, there's ego, there's five senses, there's five elements, and what are these factors that are creating reality? And so in the emanation, it's not that, you know, there's consciousness, then there's five elements, and then that made the world. But there's all these factors on a causal level. And then they mix together on a causal level, and they're working on a causal plane. And from that causal plane, they manifest a subtle dimension. And from that subtle dimension, they manifest a physical dimension. So it's not that, like... The elements are being created on the physical plane. They're already existing in their functional nature on the subtle plane. And then they come into being. So when we say pradhana, what we mean is, on that causal plane, what are these causal elements that are all existing that are what is manifesting everything that we see? They are manifesting our experience. I'm not going to say our experience of reality, because it's our experience. You know, how is it that you're experiencing? You know, am I right now tapping on your knee, or is it just an experience in your mind and it doesn't exist in reality? It might not be reality. It's whose reality? No, Frank doesn't see it. You know, it might not be happening.
You're right.
So it's an experience. So the pradhana is that which is creating experience.
Okay.
And we call it reality. We think it's real. But it's this, we are an experiencer.
So, okay. What do you call that? The experience of reality? Pradhana?
No. What it is that's making the reality? The fact that you have an ego, that you have a memory, that you have a consciousness, all these different parts, that's pradhana.
Okay.
So all those parts that are making reality, if grouping them all together, we call that pradhana.
Okay. And then
the tattva darshani, to understand, to be seers of that, we examine what is making this reality, what is making our experience.
Mm-hmm. So what about Sankhya?
Sankhya is a doctrine of explaining that.
Gotcha.
It's a system of explaining what is these elements of pradhana.
Man, this is some deep philosophy.
Oh, it's deep, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, Western philosophy.
But it's reality, you know? And I keep saying reality, but I want to drop reality and just say it's what we are experiencing.
Yeah.
Because I want to say, if I say reality, I'm saying it's a noun.
Yes.
If I say it's what we're experiencing, I'm in a verb. Uh-huh. So it's just that little bit of a difference in... It's a different... I mean something very different.
Yes. I understand what you're saying.
All right. So, 3/4 of him are in the Amrita. So, they're immortal, unchanging. And they're known by the seers of reality by proper perception of the root matter, of the pradhana. So we look at what's manifested. We look at what's manifesting everything, and by understanding what's manifesting everything, we can also understand what's on the other side. Instead of looking at our experience, we look at what is making us experience, then we're aware of where, you know, this is all coming from.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I see, Lots of good themes that keep repeating.
Yeah.
And but the Perdana in this theme within this one quarter then?
Perdana's all in the one quarter, yeah.
Okay. And all four quarters are considered Parabrahma? Is that, or no, is Parabrahma even beyond this definition?
Parabrahman, you could say, is beyond this definition. Or okay. Some would say it's the three immortal parts, or, you know, it's yeah.
Yeah, we can talk about it too much, I know, but...
If we talk okay. about it, we lost it, you know?
Yeah.
Then it says, the all-pervasive who is manifest and unmanifest. Is manifest and unmanifest is called Vasudeva. And so now I break this down. There's this little chart at the bottom of page 9. And we can see we divide it in the four quarters, and we take one quarter and we divide that in half. And that half is the unmanifest and the manifest. So three parts, they never manifest. They're beyond. Now of this one quarter, there's all these elements that are coming into existence and then being reabsorbed back, and whatever's happening and then coming back out. It's this whole flow of coming into experience, of disappearing, souls come into existence and leave, and you know, so it's manifesting and unmanifesting. Mm-hmm. But that's all only in the one quarter. The other three quarters are beyond. And I do a little comparison here with modern science. They've done this thing where they've calculated how heavy the universe must be, how much mass there has to be in order for everything to be moving at the speed and everything that's moving. And they look, and there's only a quarter of what they're supposed to be. So it means there's more mass than they're like, well, and so they call
it's
it
not manifested.
They call it dark matter, because they're like, well, according to the rules, there should be this much, but there isn't. There's only this much. And so there must be something that's just we can't see. So it's a whole nother way to say the same philosophy, in my opinion.
Did you tell him?
What do you tell him? Oh, you're talking about Vasudev and Narayan there. And they'll say, yeah, sure. you know, it's
cool. One day.
One day. Let's see, anything else to explain about that? And as I said, so it's not that this is true or false. This is a methodology and a wording for us to be able to put in a certain state of consciousness and understand something that's actually way beyond a human mind to be able to understand. So this is a way to give it a framework so that we can work with it. It's not about truth, it's about a darshana. This is giving us a perspective. And when you and I and Frank are having this perspective, then we can all have a conversation about something, because we're all calling it the same thing, basically. Even though that name might not fit exactly, it doesn't matter. We're at least referring to the same thing. All right, so Vasudeva in this context is that one quarter that's manifest. And in the Pancharatra, the whole thing together is called Narayana, which, as Frank was saying, you could also call Parabrahman on another level, where in in Sanjay's lineage, all of it is called Narayana, and just the one quarter is called the Vasudeva, and that Vasudeva is within Narayana, where Vasudeva is that manifest part of Narayana. All right. Let's see. Do we want to do more, or is that enough for tonight? We're at 18. We'll leave the Shaktis for next time. And maybe our level 2 Shakti will be with us. All right. Let's see.
All right.
So So you guys get that our goal really with the first half of this book is not just to learn Jyotish, but really change our perspective of how we're looking at reality. Or if I want to be more specific, change the way we experience. Change the way we are experiencing.
That would be
pretty cool, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. And when we're living from the world of we're experiencing the emanation of existence. Oh, then what's the level of Jyotish that we do it from that perspective? Versus thinking that there's this physical thing that maybe the gravity of Jupiter is making something happen. once you get the more emergent concept, then you hear somebody talking about gravity from Jupiter affecting something, and it's like, you just take a deep breath and you have compassion and you know that, you know, it's not their karma to have a bigger view in this life. All right. Any questions before I turn off the recording?
Not for now. We can hold.
Not till next week.
And then let's just end with this Parashara's little prayer. You have an honorable question for the welfare of the world. Now, bowing to the Para Brahman, his power, the word, and the sun, Lord of the Grahas, who causes the universe to produce its effects, I will speak about the eye of the Vedas, as heard from the mouth of Brahma.